In this lecture, I'd like to introduce you to six people I've become fairly close to over the past few years, even though I don't know their names. All of these unidentified victims were discovered in my home county of Hamilton in Ohio, and all of their cases have gone cold. Their stories help highlight some of the most remarkable developments I've witnessed in forensic science over my nearly 30 years of practice. From my graduate student internship with my mentor, forensic anthropologist Dr. Anthony Perzigian from the University of Cincinnati, up until today. Unknown persons are commonly known as John or Jane Doe in the U.S., but called Joe Bloggs in the U.K. and Ashok Kumar in India. Unfortunately, some can be called Baby Doe, since the unidentified dead also include abandoned newborns and young children. During my career, some methods related to human ID haven't really changed much. We still use visual observations like scars, marks, and tattoos. We use fingerprints, medical details from autopsy. And for skeletons, the same specific measurements and x-rays as when I started. But there have been changes. For instance, computer technology has definitely changed how we analyze measurements of the skeleton. When I first started in anthropology, we used some fairly cumbersome mathematical formulas to help assess which sex, ancestry, and height was a best fit to an unknown person. Today, much of that's done by computer software, particularly a package known as FORDIS 3.0. The following six cases date from 1986 to the present, the exact span of years I've been involved in forensic anthropology. My focus on them relates to a partnership I organized in February of 2012 called Project Identify. It's a cooperative effort between the Hamilton County Coroner's and Sheriff's Offices, a local news reporter, and a small team of my students from Mount St. Joseph University. We've reopened these cold cases using the National Missing and Unidentified Persons System, NAMIS, which is a database that uses sophisticated computer algorithms to try to match missing and unknown persons. We've given each victim a code name to help remind us of the person's humanity. And since those are much easier than case numbers in discussions among Project ID members, together our group hopes to find answers to some long-standing mysteries. In the heat of the summer, July 8th of 1986, a woman reported a foul odor coming from a vacant building on Republic Street in a rundown area of Cincinnati. The Cincinnati Homicide Squad found the badly decomposed, partially skeletonized remains of what looked to be a middle-aged male who had perhaps been there a week or so. His body was clothed, and there appeared to be no signs of foul play. The man had barricaded himself inside the building, so we refer to him as the settler. The body was transported to the Hamilton County Coroner's Office for an autopsy. But due to the degree of decomposition, the cause and manner of death were ruled undetermined, and fingerprints couldn't be obtained. His remains weighed 94 pounds, but that really can't be used to estimate any type of living weight. Both visual cues and mathematical formulas suggested the victim was a man of African ancestry. And using the length of his femur or thigh bone, the man's height was estimated in the range of about 5 feet 6 inches to 5 feet 10 inches. His age was likely over 50 years based on degenerative changes in the skeleton, including some arthritis in his spine. A very poor state of dental health was thought maybe to reflect a low socioeconomic status. Some badly healed fractures suggested the man had, at one time, suffered a broken nose and rib. Records indicate that local missing persons files were consulted in 1986, and 5 specific possibilities were checked out, but nothing. The death investigator's notes say that several months before the body was discovered, a neighbor had chased a, quote, vagrant from the building. Although that could have been the victim, the neighbor knew nothing about the man's identity. The final note in the record indicates that full body x-rays were taken to aid any future inquiries, and clothing was fully photographed before being disposed. Now, this was in 1986, before computers were at all commonplace. So the autopsy records I obtained to develop this man's NamUs record were from microfilm. Now, some of you younger folks may not even know what microfilm is, but it was a long-standing archival process in which documents were photographed as tiny film records for easier storage. In order to view the records, you need to pull the needed film out of a file and magnify it on a special machine. You can print from the viewer, but the quality is often poor. In fact, when the settlers' records were microfilmed, the camera must have been slightly out of focus because the documents are terribly difficult to read, and there's nothing that can be done about that. Once microfilmed, the original paper records were destroyed to save space, as was common practice. Unfortunately, his x-rays and images of his clothing were also destroyed during routine record purging over the years. How about DNA? Well, the first forensic use of DNA technology occurred in 1986, the same year the settlers' remains were discovered. But DNA sampling didn't become routine until over 10 years later. So what options are left now? The man's remains are buried in Wesleyan Cemetery in Cincinnati, so perhaps could be exhumed for DNA. But that cemetery has a notorious past of some managers that were less than reputable. It had poor record keeping and even an office fire at one point. So in the summer of 2013, students from Project ID and I teamed up with some civil engineering interns from Cincinnati State, a local technical college, and we tried to map the portion of the cemetery where records indicated the settler was buried. But there are very few headstones in the area, and his grave probably never had one. Besides, it's sad to say, what are the odds that someone is still looking for that poor man who was likely homeless? Remember, even if we could locate his grave and get a DNA sample from his skeleton, we would need a relative to come forward and likewise contribute a sample for comparison. At this point, I believe since the settler barricaded himself in a building, maybe indicating he didn't want to be discovered or known by others, that's probably the way he will stay, unidentified and with only limited information in his NamUs record. On October 27th of 1988, around 8:30 in the evening, a woman who lived on Broadway in downtown Cincinnati was leaving her home and saw the crumpled body of a young man at the bottom of the stairwell leading to her apartment building's basement. Emergency responders drove the man to University Hospital, where he was pronounced dead on arrival. Cincinnati police officers brought his body to the Hamilton County Coroner's Office, which is literally across the street from the hospital. Although the exact time of death wasn't known, Broadway is a busy downtown street, and the man likely hadn't been dead for more than a few hours. He was fully dressed, wearing a red hooded sweatshirt, blue jeans with a brown belt, white socks, and gray and white gym shoes, as well as a Timex wristwatch. The man had no identification and only 70 cents in his pocket. An autopsy revealed his cause of death was blunt force trauma to the head of an undetermined manner, meaning his death couldn't be ruled as homicide, suicide, or an accident. There was no way to know whether his injuries were from falling down the stairwell or having been pushed. But toxicology revealed the man's blood alcohol level was 0.08%, which is the current legal limit for intoxication. There were no other drugs in his system. Now, this 20 to 30-year-old man, who Project ID refers to as Broadway Doe, had a completely recognizable face. He had wavy brown hair, about 4 inches long, blue eyes, and was healthy, well-nourished, and well-groomed, including a neatly trimmed mustache and clean-cut fingernails. He weighed 137 pounds and was 5'8" tall. A full set of fingerprints was taken, his blood type noted as O positive, and he was fully photographed, including the scars on his forehead, shoulder, hands, and leg, two of which showed signs of having been stitched. All of these details about this young man, including a police artist's sketch of his face, were released to the local media. But no one came forth with information, or if they did, nothing's recorded in the coroner's office paperwork. Our forensic odontologist, who, like me, started as a consultant to the office in 1986, generated a complete dental chart for Broadway Doe. His body was kept in the cold locker at the Hamilton County Coroner's Office for 5 months before being buried in Wesleyan Cemetery at the end of March in 1989. At the time of Broadway Doe's discovery, I had no involvement in his case. Anthropology services weren't needed. He wasn't decomposed. But when I went to the coroner's office to get unidentified persons records for input into Namus in 2009, I was able to get his autopsy report, his dental charting, and numerous photographs. Images of his clothing, though, had been purged. Just about everything else was in his record, though, including a notation that his fingerprints were on file with the Cincinnati Police Department. Unfortunately, no one's been able to locate that fingerprint record. It appears it was inadvertently discarded over the years. In 1988, DNA sampling was still very rare, and I figured that would be a dead end. But amazingly, in March of 2013, the DNA analyst at the coroner's crime lab found an envelope with Broadway Doe's case number on it in their frozen archives. It contained what's called a blood card. That's a small paper record that's impregnated with a few drops of blood that can be used for future testing. And as unbelievably good luck would have it, 25 years after his death, the Namus DNA lab was able to generate a genetic profile for Broadway Doe. The DNA doesn't stop there, though, because the lab can upload encoded DNA information from unidentified and missing persons into a national DNA registry known as CODIS. That stands for the Combined DNA Index System, which is a self-searching database with algorithms that routinely and automatically search all of its records against each other. Unfortunately, so far, we haven't gotten a hit for Broadway Doe. But perhaps someone will see this lecture, or the media releases we continue to push, or maybe look on Namus and say to themselves, I wonder if that man could be my brother, father, or son that I haven't seen since 1988. It's just so hard to imagine that no one back in 1988 or to this day seems to be looking for this young man. And because that is so hard for me to imagine, I'm going to believe that someone is looking for him and will someday find him. At least that way his friends and family will know what happened. It's so sad to think a grieving mother, wife, brother, or some other relative may be out there right now thinking that that young man simply stopped caring and disappeared. Of the six unidentified persons found in Hamilton County since 1986, surprisingly, the one we knew the least about was alive when he was found. On May 27, 1992, about 10:35 in the morning, train yard workers phoned the Cincinnati Fire Department to report a man lying along the tracks. An emergency squad took the man, who reportedly smelled of alcohol and was unresponsive, to University Hospital, where he was admitted in a coma. Physicians determined he had suffered a stroke in a vital area of his brainstem. The man never regained consciousness, was declared brain dead 2 days later, and they removed life support. The next day, the Hamilton County Coroner's Office conducted an autopsy, which showed the man suffered from numerous illnesses. In addition to the stroke, he had heart disease, hardening of the arteries, fluid and clots in his lungs, kidney problems, and cancer in both his prostate and parathyroid glands. He was a black man, estimated to be in his 50s or 60s, who stood 6'1" tall, and he weighed 206 pounds. He had brown eyes, curly black and gray hair, and a full beard and mustache. The man had no upper teeth and few lower teeth, and his nails were noted to be dirty. Other than the stroke, there was no evidence of injuries, so the man's death was ruled as from natural causes. In 1992, missing persons records from both Hamilton County and the city of Cincinnati were checked, but nobody came forth with information. Maybe the man had come from somewhere else, perhaps by jumping on the train. The forensic dentist was apparently not consulted to generate a chart, so all we had to go on were the notes about his dental pattern from the autopsy report. Records indicate fingerprints were taken and provided to the local police for comparisons, with both missing persons and criminal fingerprint records, but nothing panned out. As time went on, and tracks, as we've come to call them, was not readily identified, his fingerprint records were apparently discarded. Now, my theory is that since his death was ruled from natural causes, And it wasn't the responsibility of the police to identify him. The records were purged. I assume the coroner thought the police had the prints on file, and law enforcement probably assumed the coroner's office had kept a copy. But that left us with next to nothing to help identify this man. No dental records, no fingerprints, and no DNA sample was taken. There was only the most basic description of his clothing, and unbelievably, not even any photograph. This man was alive when discovered, and we don't even have a picture of his face. Now, that was over 20 years ago, and I'm confident that wouldn't happen today. Things were just so different back then. That's one of the lessons I've learned from this project. In 2013, I was able to find one new piece of information. The Cincinnati Fire Department Emergency Medical Squad still had the microfilm version of the EMS run sheet from the day they transported this man. Now, it's very difficult to read, but my students and I believe the name Bill is listed in the box marked first name on the paperwork. There's a question mark in the box for a last name. Is it possible the man was still conscious when EMS arrived and provided his first name? It's not much help, but at least it was a new direction to be pursued, so that was added to his NamUs record. With so little to go on, though, the coroner decided tracks would be exhumed. In March of 2014, his grave was opened, and as I give this lecture, this man's DNA profile is being generated. I'm excited to say we're arranging for a forensic artist to reconstruct his facial appearance. For over 10 years, Hamilton County did not have another unidentified or chronically unidentified victim. And personally, I don't think that's an accident. Tracks was found in 1992, and 2 years later, Hamilton County got its first new coroner in over 30 years. Things quickly started to change and modernize. The office got a new centralized computer system, and records since then are practically impeccable. Photos were either taken with a digital camera or promptly digitized for archiving. DNA has become routine in unidentified cases. Though, as we'll see, that doesn't always guarantee a positive ID. On May 17th of 2003, a tugboat operator contacted the Cincinnati Police Department to report a body floating in the river near the city's public landing. The deceased was an unknown black male who was decomposed to the point that his facial features were too distorted to be of any help. The body was brought to the Hamilton County Morgue for an autopsy, but there were no obvious injuries, and neither the cause nor manner of death could be determined. The man's age was estimated as between 20 and 40 years. He was 6 feet tall and weighed 220 pounds. No distinctive bodily features could be seen, like scars or tattoos, and although he had brown hair, his eyes were already too cloudy to be certain of their natural color. The man was wearing blue jeans, and we know the specific brand, size, and length. The toxicology report showed no evidence of drugs or alcohol, but results can be affected by decomposition. The office's forensic dentist conducted a complete dental examination with x-rays on Riverman, as we like to call him. A full DNA profile was developed and uploaded into the National CODIS database. The one viable fingerprint that could be rolled was submitted to the FBI and uploaded into their Integrated Automated Fingerprint Identification System, IAFIS. This computerized fingerprint database, launched in 1999, allows comparisons between unknown prints and any records in its files. Because the coroner's office was fully computerized by this time, all information about this case is easily accessible and permanently archived. One entry in the death investigator's portion of the record indicates that 5 days before Riverman's body was discovered, a pair of concerned citizens had contacted Cincinnati police to report that a black male dressed in a gray shirt and blue jeans with his shoes in his hand jumped from one of the bridges that span the Ohio River in Cincinnati. Although that man probably was our victim and lost his shirt in the fall in the water, we still don't know his identity. But we do know exactly where he's buried in the event that some new technology is developed that could further aid his identification. Since we can't predict what the future holds, and because some religions object to cremation, unidentified remains should never be incinerated. 3 years later, on November 29th of 2006, another body was found in the Ohio River by workers at a grain shipping facility, but this time west of the city, very near the university where I teach. The body was that of a woman who is estimated to have been dead a day or two at most, since she was still in rigor mortis. She was white and estimated as 50 to 70 years old, with hazel eyes and light brown hair with dyed blonde highlights. She was 5 feet 2 inches tall and weighed 134 pounds. Her death was due to drowning, but no one knows whether she fell into the water or was pushed, perhaps off one of the gambling boats that travel that stretch of the river. We call this victim Pearl because of the pair of pearl-style necklaces she was wearing, in addition to a black skirt, black blouse, pantyhose, bra, and panties. Her white tennis shoes suggested she wanted to walk comfortably, but she was otherwise dressed up, complete with nail polish and lipstick. That's another reason investigators think she may have been on one of the local gambling boats or one of the sightseeing cruises. Although those boats require tickets, they don't take names, nor do they necessarily count heads when guests are departing the boat and returning to shore. Pearl didn't have the type of massive internal injuries that would signify she went off a bridge, nor did her body show the typical signs of damage seen when a body travels far in the river, colliding with floating debris. The woman showed no evidence of prior surgeries or any significant medical conditions. She had a touch of arthritis in her spine and her hands, consistent with a woman of that age, as well as stretch marks on her abdomen, suggesting that at least at one time she had given birth. I imagine that somewhere her children, maybe even grandchildren, are wondering where she is and why she hasn't reached out to them in years now. Perhaps the person who might be looking for her normally, like a husband or boyfriend, is the one responsible for her death. Otherwise, why didn't anyone report her disappearance? On the 5th of January in 2009, two people picking up aluminum cans along the road discovered the last of our 6 unidentified Hamilton County cases. The remains were completely skeletonized, so normally I would have gone to the scene, but I was out of town teaching at a death investigator's seminar. The bones were scattered under some brush in a wooded area near a major highway. Some badly tattered clothing was associated with the remains, with other items, including 2 rings nearby. There was evidence of carnivore scavenging on the bones, and the skeletal elements were scattered around the area. Several agencies assisted in the recovery, and cadaver dogs were used in the search. The following week, I examined the bones at the Hamilton County Morgue. Based on visual observations and measurements that I input into forensic 4DIS software, I told them the person was a Caucasian female who stood between 5 feet 1.5 and 5 feet 6 inches tall. Now that's a wide range, but anthropologists have learned much more about normal human variation over the years, and that has to be taken into consideration. It's too limiting to report a narrow window, since people searching for a missing person could easily dismiss a victim if we didn't include the full statistical range. Using methods developed to assess aspects of the ribcage and pelvis, 2 areas that demonstrate specific and well-studied age-related changes, I estimated the woman was between around 40 and 65 years of age when she died. Other noteworthy features included a poor state of dental care and very rugged landmarks on the muscle attachment sites of her lower limbs, which suggested to me she spent a lot of time walking. Now, taken together with the mix of remaining clothing, which was the waistband of men's cotton briefs that had disintegrated under polyester sweatpants, plus a bra and remnants of a sequin top, I thought she was probably a homeless person who maybe created a makeshift encampment near the highway, perhaps to rest, or maybe she wasn't feeling well. The condition of her clothing and moss growing on her inexpensive gym shoes suggested to me the remains had been there for many months, if not years. The forensic dentist was consulted and DNA samples submitted to the Namus DNA lab for upload into CODIS. The remains of this woman, whom we've dubbed the Traveler due to apparently being homeless and on the move a lot, are still available at the Hamilton County Morgue. So in spring of 2013, I requested we submit her skull to a forensic artist for a facial reconstruction. I also asked if my Project ID students and some others from my forensic science class could visit the site to learn more about the location. To our surprise, over 4 years after the remains were discovered, we not only found a few more small bones that were likely scattered by the carnivore activity, but we also found an upper denture that the forensic dentist was able to fit to this woman's skull. The findings of my anthropology exam, along with the skull and the denture, were provided to a forensic artist in Florida who was doing reconstructions for unidentified dead in the NamUs system. By summer of 2013, we had an image to use in a new press release that was heavily covered in the local media. We knew it was a long shot, but had hopes that as the years passed, people might now start to be wondering why they hadn't seen this woman in so long. Maybe a relative of hers, or someone from a local social services agency. Sadly, so far, nothing's panned out. The traveler's facial reconstruction was so good, though, we asked the artist to do additional work for Project ID. We provided her the morgue photographs of both Broadway Doe from 1988 and Pearl from 2006. The artist was able to use computer software, along with the known eye colors of both victims, to generate a lifelike appearance for presentation to the public, both in NamUs and in posters that Project ID students created to be distributed throughout the area. The problem with local distribution, though, is obvious. If any of these people were from the greater Cincinnati area, they'd probably have been identified by now. Given that DNA profiles of four of the six, Broadway Doe, Riverman, Pearl, and the Traveler, are already uploaded to the CODIS National Database, as Trax soon will be, and since fingerprints of Riverman and Pearl are entered into the IAFIS National Database, well, we thought maybe no one was actively looking for any of these people. Since the NamUs database is publicly searchable, it also seemed unlikely that relatives were using NamUs to find any of these six individuals. But amazingly, as I stand here delivering this lecture, as of just last week, it appears one of our six unknown persons will very soon be identified. A DNA profile is currently being generated for someone who believes she's a family member of one of our Project ID cases. Due to the ongoing investigation surrounding the victim's death, I can't reveal which case. But I am fairly certain and very hopeful that by the time you hear this, one of our six persons will once again have a name. Now, since I can't talk about that case, let me tell you about a different identification success story. On June 24th of 1975, the decomposing body of an unknown drowning victim was discovered in the Scioto River in Ross County, Ohio. He was a white male, 5 feet 11 inches tall, weighing around 150 pounds, with an age estimated between 30 and 65 years. The man had brown eyes, was clean shaven, and had brown hair about 6 inches in length. His body was autopsied the next day at the Hamilton County Coroner's Office. And when no identity could be confirmed after 4 months, despite dissemination of the information in the media, the remains were released for burial as a John Doe. In late 2009, when I was employed part-time as a consultant with NamUs, I learned of this case and obtained the man's information to start a NamUs record. The current death investigator in Ross County got very interested in the case, and he worked really hard to figure out new angles, despite an almost 35-year time lag. We were able to use federal resources to exhume this man's body for DNA testing and get a thorough dental exam. His skull was sent to a forensic artist, the same one who helped in the Project ID cases, and the image of the clay reconstruction she created was released to the media. A woman saw the image in the newspaper and contacted authorities. In September of 2012, based on a DNA comparison with a family member, the man was identified as 40-year-old Arthur Raymond Flowers, a veteran who had been missing since June of 1975, having been last seen at a VA hospital where he was being treated for depression. Mr. Flowers' niece was finally able to bring Arthur home to his family 37 years after he disappeared.